But yeah, so I'm a philosopher by training, and I work in philosophy of science and in ethics, and I teach bioethics at MSU. I also teach environmental ethics, contemporary moral problems. So I have the fun job of talking about lots of super controversial things that people really vehemently disagree about. And just as a kind of warning, because I am a philosopher, I will probably raise more questions than I will provide answers. But I'm hoping to just kind of give an overview, talk a little bit about what gene editing is, what some of the different techniques that are being used now, some of the terminology, just so that we all kind of have a basic understanding of that and how it works. And then what are some of the potential applications and benefits? It's a really exciting time, especially for a lot of scientists working with gene editing techniques like the CRISPR-Cas system. And so what are the potential benefits for society that might come out of a lot of this research? And then I'm going to talk a little bit about what the potential risks and ethical concerns are. What are some of the ways in which this could potentially negatively impact society? And then I'm going to sort of close with a question that I'm hoping we'll be able to discuss for quite a while. I'm hoping to only talk for about 30 minutes. But, you know, who decides what sorts of risks are acceptable or not? How do we make that decision? And is that something that is just to be left to scientists? What are the ways that all of us as citizens can sort of influence and participate in these kind of decisions that really impact all of us? So I'm going to start just by talking a little bit, very little, because I'm not the scientist, about the science of genetic editing and engineering. How many of you were at the side trip with Blake Weidenheft? Okay, great. So I am going to show just a really short 2-minute video about CRISPR in particular, just to kind of get the idea. But CRISPRs, as many of you probably already know, are short DNA sequences with unique spacer sequences. And they work with, there's a couple of different proteins that that are being used, but Cas9 is the one that's gotten the most attention recently. And together they constitute a kind of adaptive immune system that really occurs in nature. I believe Dr. Weidenheft talks a lot about how he really got curious about this research by doing research even as an undergraduate at MSU, looking at bacteria in Yellowstone and how they survive and adapt. And they've been used to kind of be able to edit or cut pieces of DNA and insert new material. And so I'm going to just show a really short 2-minute video that kind of explains the science.
By now, there's a good chance you've heard of CRISPR. It's what scientists are using to engineer seedless tomatoes, monochromatic butterflies, and even extra lean piglets. CRISPR is essentially a find-and-replace function for DNA, and in the hands of scientists, it's a super powerful molecular tool for rewriting the code of life. So how does CRISPR work? Imagine this little toy train track is your DNA, and the genetic code that you want to swap out is this bit right here. So scientists designed a short sequence of code called guide RNA that matches the bit you want to replace. Then they attach the guide RNA to a protein called Cas9. Together, they roam the cell's nucleus until they find a matching piece of DNA. Then they lock on and go to work. Cas9 unzips the DNA and splits the guide RNA to make sure it's a match. If it is, Cas9 does the DNA too. Scientists can use this to snip out a troublesome chunk of genetic code, like, say, a mutation that causes Huntington's disease. Then they can coax the cell to stitch in a new gene where the old one used to be, using the cell's natural DNA repair machinery. This is called gene editing, and it's exactly why CRISPR is such a big deal. And scientists aren't the only ones using it. Agricultural companies are designing crops that are resistant to climate change, super nutritious vegetables, and even apples that don't turn brown. Pharmaceutical firms are using it to develop new classes of antibiotics and other life-saving medicines. One day soon, doctors might even prescribe CRISPR-based therapies to treat genetic diseases like cystic fibrosis or sickle cell anemia. And Cas9 isn't the only protein that works with CRISPR. There's also Cas3, which gobbles up DNA Pac-Man style, wherever it attaches. And there's one called Sherlock, which targets RNA to the DNA and can smooth out the presence of viruses. Designer foods, animals, drugs, these are just some of the ways CRISPR has already changed biology. But scientists are just beginning to explore all that this technology might one day deliver, good and bad. The question now is how we keep this world-changing technology from going off the rails.
So, the interesting thing is that CRISPR has actually gotten lots of attention, starting in about 2012, 2015, was a big year for CRISPR. But gene editing is actually not new. It's things that scientists have been doing really since like the 1980s. What is particularly exciting and transformative about CRISPR is that it's, an incredibly cost-effective, cheap kind of technology. So the other gene editing techniques that were used require lots of expensive equipment, lots of expert knowledge, lots of expensive materials. And so CRISPR has kind of, you know, really flung open the doors to what's possible. And indeed, you might have heard of people now, you can actually get, the materials to be able to edit a genome even in the back of one's garage. It also takes very little scientific expertise. Indeed, I know some of you might have attended the public forum when Jennifer Doudna, who was one of the inventors of CRISPR, came to the MSU campus. And we asked a group of students in one of the sessions with her, you know, how many of them had actually already done some gene editing. Mm-hmm. And more than half of them raised their hand. Which is incredible, undergraduates, right? You know, including freshmen. So that's astounding. I mean, Blake Weidenhoff also commented that when he was an undergraduate, you know, it would have been like one person, right? So the opportunities have just kind of increased exponentially. I also want to just distinguish a little bit between a couple of different kinds of what might be called genetic manipulation or modification technologies. Some of this vocabulary is kind of slippery, you might notice. It's not always clear what people are talking about. When we talk about GMOs in foods, genetically modified foods, for example, some people get confused because really, of course, we've been modifying the DNA of crops for hundreds of years, right? We have bred plants. But typically when people are talking about this, what they sometimes mean is not just, you know, sort of breeding, but insertion of genetic material that's from a different organism, right? So that's a potentially important distinction. And indeed, the FDA and the USDA, that's a distinction that they rely on. If you're introducing into some kind of food product DNA from another species, then it's considered genetically modified. That's going to be an important point we'll come back to a little bit later when we see some things that are currently being done with CRISPR and cattle, for example. Another distinction that is potentially important, a lot of the ethical concerns, especially when we think about genome editing in humans, has to do with germline modifications. So germline cells are those cells that are passed on, right, through reproduction to offspring, whereas somatic cell modifications are not. A lot of the concerns that people have is with germline editing because, of course, then those edits are kind of permanently passed on, right, to future generations and become part of the sort of baseline of the human genome. Whereas somatic cells, you know, that's most of the experimentation that's been permitted has been in somatic cells so that those traits are not necessarily passed on until we understand better some of the potential risks. There's also, I think, an important distinction between talking about gene therapy versus genetic enhancement, right? So some of the arguments that get made about both the benefit and the risks of CRISPR especially the benefits, really focus on gene therapy, where we're trying to make modifications that would remove a disease, right? Remove a mutation that causes a disease, something that would prevent some kind of very serious health problem or treat some kind of serious health problem. But very quickly often the conversation slides from talking about, you know, addressing difficult health conditions to what gets called gene enhancement. And in the case of crops, as you saw with the apple that doesn't turn brown or the seedless tomatoes, right? Those are really enhancements, ways of manipulating genes so that we get some kind of better product. And so when we talk about it with respect to humans, that obviously also starts to make people nervous. So it goes quickly from, you know, treating or curing things like sickle cell anemia or Huntington's disease, as mentioned in the video, to, well, can we have designer babies, right, where people will be able to select for hair color, eye color, height, perfect pitch, you know. In many cases, people talk about intelligence. And with genetic enhancement, we also have to be careful because sometimes the kind of traits that people are talking about are not the sorts of ones that we've identified or can control. The science is not there. So with those kind of basic distinctions in mind, I want to just... Oh, one other one I forgot, and this is an important one. The other sort of technique that's being used right now is to create synthetic gene drives. How many people have heard of a gene drive? Okay. So a gene drive is actually something that there are gene drives that occur in nature, right? A gene drive is when you have a genetic trait that is able to be spread through a population very, very quickly. So typically, without this kind of gene drive, right, the probability that some trait will be passed to an offspring is like 50%. But with gene drives, it's kind of like the supercharged, you know, selfish part of the gene. You're able to have that trait passed on in sometimes like 99% of offspring. So very, very quickly, right? So you can spread a trait through a population very quickly. Now, some of those already do occur in nature, but the event of CRISPR-Cas has been used to also have synthetic gene drives where you can introduce a genetic edit into a population very, very quickly. And one place where that's being done, and this is to sort of talk about some of the potential benefits, but there have been some fantastic experiments with mosquitoes and malaria and with an eye towards things like Zika, right, and malaria. And so scientists have been able to create a malaria-resistant mosquito by editing part of their DNA. And using that kind of gene drive technology, they've been able to... breed mosquitoes so that that malaria resistance gets passed on to about 99% of the offspring when they're bred even with normal mosquitoes. Okay, so you can imagine how quickly that could spread. Other areas where CRISPR is thought to be really promising is in battling neurodegenerative diseases, right, like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. So they've been able to, the CRISPR-based platforms have been developed to identify genes that control the cellular processes that lead to some of those diseases. And hopefully, there's a lot of hope that this may indeed generate new treatments. So there's also been a lot of work being done in the area of HIV and certain other viruses and blood diseases. So the CRISPR has been successful in they've been able to remove the virus DNA from some HIV patients using CRISPR technologies. And there's hope that that's going to be expanded to several other diseases as well. As mentioned in the video, pharmaceutical companies are also working with these technologies to develop all sorts of new drugs to treat things like sickle cell anemia and even cancer. There's hope that this is going to lead to certain cancer treatments. And also in agriculture, in China, there have been experiments that have edited the genes that control things like muscle growth and hair growth so as to produce much more meat in the cattle industry, as well as more wool. So there's a hair inhibitor gene that's then sort of turned off to produce more hair. Here, and I know that here in the U.S., one of the kinds of things that have been done is to anybody who has been a rancher in the past in the audience? Okay, a couple people at least. So, as many people who've worked on ranches know, cattle horns can be dangerous. And so typically a lot of times cattle horns are removed, with a process that basically involves cutting off the horn and then, cauterizing the horn buds on animals, which obviously can be quite painful for animals. With CRISPR, they've been able to generate cattle that basically don't grow their horns, right, for that. And there's been a lot of experiments, particularly with dairy cows, in order to do that. Also, lots of stuff with food, right? Being able to try to create or to engineer crops so that they'll be drought-resistant, resistant to other sorts of conditions that may come about as a result of climate change. Some of it is more on the enhancement side, like the apples that don't turn brown or the seedless tomatoes. But you can imagine the possibilities there. The other area where CRISPR has been really promising is actually there's a lot of hope that CRISPR technology is going to help us reduce our reliance on petrochemicals. So, for example, there's experiments that are being done where CRISPR is being used to modify yeast in a particular way so that with the sugars it's able to produce plastics, but without the use of petrochemicals. Mm-hmm. And the way that it's often talked about is that, you know, reducing our reliance on those chemicals is also going to have really good impacts for the environment, right? So the potential is pretty incredible. I know my colleague Blake Wyden talks about it as like this is the new internet, right? That it's going to completely transform our lives. That it has the potential to address a range of social issues, from disease to the environment to our food supply, to helping us adapt towards climate change and other challenges that we face. And that is all incredibly exciting. There are also, as with any technology, right, some potential risks and trade-offs and concerns. And so my job as ethicist, you know, often is to kind of remind, you know, I share the enthusiasm of my science colleagues very much, but to also remind them that there are very serious ethical issues that are also at stake. So I'm going to talk about really briefly about three different kinds of ethical concerns, just really broadly speaking. I'm going to go through each of these one by one. But the first is sort of concerns about that gene drive technology in particular, about spreading a trait through a population really rapidly. The second concern is about off-target effects. So what happens if CRISPR accidentally edits or deletes or changes in some way a part of the genome that they're not intending to, right? And also concerns in general about human genome editing in particular, and particularly when we think about germline edits. Okay, so the first concern is the concern of the impacts of gene drives. And the malaria-resistant mosquito, I think, is a great example of how this technology could be fantastic, for preventing diseases like malaria, Zika, right? And diseases that affect, that really impact particularly people in the global south, particularly poor communities. So it could have a really revolutionizing effect on human global health. However, there are also attempts underway at looking, I mean, another trait that they've been able to successfully edit in mosquitoes is the ability to reproduce, right? So what that means is, and if that's a trait, an inability to reproduce, that could then be passed very quickly through a population, that basically means that we could extinct, you know, an entire species could go extinct very quickly, right? So, the other place where they're using this, where they're using traits that basically destroy a population, is with invasive species, right? Now, I mean, again, so invasive species can be a problem. And so if there was some way to eradicate a species very quickly in a particular geographical area, that, could be good. But the other important thing to keep in mind is these are our systems that we don't completely control. And the mosquitoes are a good example of this because even if, for example, we had some kind of regulations about the use of technology, of this kind of technology in the U.S., it doesn't mean our mosquitoes are going to stay within our borders, right? And other countries may do very different things. And so this is one of the concerns. There's also concerns that this sort of thing is the kind of thing that could be weaponized, right? Now, on the one hand, I know that Jennifer Doudna, when she was here in the fall, she talked about this and said, well, you know, there's always a risk to any technology that somebody's going to do something bad with it, like weaponize it, right? You know, the nuclear bomb is an example that people often use, right? But I think there is a very important difference because it's precisely because CRISPR-Cas is so cheap at the moment, right? And also so easily used by people, even who don't have, you know, a very, very high degree of expertise and training. It doesn't take a lot of fancy equipment, right? That's different than the nuclear bomb, right? So it's accessible in a way that other technologies that were very powerful and dangerous, you know, haven't been in the past. There's another sort of set of concerns, which is probably one of the largest set of concerns, which is this concern about off-target effects. So the reason why there's this concern really has to do with the way CRISPR functions. You sort of saw in the video, right, there's, you know, CRISPR kind of acts like a homing beacon, right, and goes to the part of the train track where, you know, it matches the RNA. But the problem is that in the entire genetic code in the entire genome of a living organism, there are multiple places where that might be a match, right? One of the explanations I saw that I think brings home this point very well is, you know, imagine that you have a postal service and you have a package addressed to 123 Main Street. Okay. Now the thing is it's going to go to 123 Main Street. But of course, in the U.S., how many 123 Main Streets are there? There are, in fact, several. So there's a concern, and there indeed have been cases where, you know, the worry is that, you know, once this is introduced, it could delete DNA that was not intended to be deleted, or that it could activate a DNA site that wasn't intended to be activated, and particularly concerns that it might activate like a cancer site. And indeed, there's at least one instance where that appears to have happened in an experiment, unfortunately, with a young child who then contracted leukemia. The human experiments, I should emphasize, to the extent that they're being permitted, tend to only be permitted in people who are terminally ill. So, you know, but nonetheless, you know, these are real concerns. I would say that scientists now, especially now that they're using Cas9 in particular, they are hopeful that they're going to be able to get off-target effects down to like 1%, which is a pretty good rate. I mean, the 1%, if the 1% probability is to get cancer, right? You know, that's a value judgment. Is that risk worth it or not, right? Also, there are some scientists that have raised concerns about the kinds of experiments that scientists do to track off-target effects. You know, part of the problem is it's very difficult to know exactly what you're looking for and where you're looking for in seeing whether or not an off-target effect has occurred. So one scientist I heard compared it to trying to chase a polar bear in a snowstorm, or, you know, someone who's drunk trying to look for their keys in the dark, right? That, you know, in part it's knowing about where to look and what exactly you're looking for, that is hard. So, but many are concerned about the possibility of our off-target effects, and particularly when we're thinking about human subject testing, right, in humans, the possibility of having, you know, very serious unforeseen side effects along those lines. The third set of concerns really raise more around this issue in particular of editing the human genome, and especially germline edits. So one of the concerns is just that we may actually permanently change, make permanent changes to the human genome in ways that, you know, may or may not have some unforeseen consequence in the future. This is also a problem when we think about doing human subject testing, because typically, right, when we do human subject testing, we require informed consent, right? And we might be able to inform patients about what the possible risks are or the possible uncertainties are, and an individual might still consent to such an experiment. But the problem is then if you have offspring, and those offspring have offspring, right? Those future generations haven't consented to this, right? So the concern is that there are tricky issues with informed consent because we have no way to really get the consent of people who might be affected in the future. So that's a concern. There are also worries about eugenics, right, and the specter of eugenics that gets raised by some of this. So earlier I made the distinction between gene therapy versus gene enhancement. And there are already many people who are very excited that, you know, we could use these kind of technologies to breed stronger, taller, faster, leaner humans, right? Also people who talk about things like intelligence, perfect pitch, you know, mathematical ability, right? Again, some of the discussion about these things is getting ahead of the science, right? It's thinking more about kind of what could be possible. But nonetheless, there's a concern that there's kind of a slippery slope that we talk about. We start off by talking about things like curing Huntington's or curing very serious genetic diseases. And then we talk about curing blindness and deafness and things like that. And then it starts moving into things like height or weight or perfect pitch, you know, getting rid of obesity, these sort of things where there are several concerns that arise. One concern that often arises with these sorts of things is that it's going to potentially reinforce certain already existing social and economic inequalities. With many technologies in the past, like in vitro fertilization, genetic screening, many of these things have been touted because of their, you know, therapeutic properties or preventative properties, and yet not everyone can afford them. And oftentimes there are things that are not covered by insurance, right? And even though CRISPR is potentially this very cheap, accessible technology, there's a lot of financial stakes. There's a lot of financial interests at stake, right? These technologies get patented. Decisions get made about how much they're going to cost. Health insurance makes decisions about what they're going to cover and what they're not going to cover. And that impacts people, right? So there's a concern that these technologies may only be available or accessible to those who are already fairly well off. And in particular, insofar as they are used to make certain kind of enhancements, that might also exacerbate certain inequalities. The other big thorny issue here at stake in a lot of the research that's being started now, and China, again, has already started doing some experiments. Also, the UK has done some experiments with human embryos with CRISPR. In both cases, they were destroyed. They were donated from in vitro fertilization clinics, so they were leftover embryos, and they were destroyed after a very short time, actually, in both cases. But in some ways, this kind of raises, again, a debate that's not new either. We saw it with stem cells, you know, it's happening again. But there are many people who are concerned about testing on human embryos and genetic alteration of human embryos, because the moral status of human embryos is not clear. It's something that people really disagree about. As we saw, I think, very vividly in the debate over stem cell research in this country, you know, several years ago, that, you know, many people are not comfortable with the idea that you know, if you're somebody who believes that life begins at conception, these sorts of experiments amount to something similar to experiments on humans, on children. And so there are some people that are concerned with that. Others obviously make the argument that, you know, a fertilized egg or a zygote has a very different status than a child, right? And what we might find acceptable to do to a zygote is different than what we might find acceptable to do to a child. And in many cases, again, the embryos that are used are from these in vitro fertilization clinics. They are things that are likely to be destroyed in either case. And so even some people who have very conflicting moral and religious beliefs might make the argument that, well, you know, at least this is maybe potentially doing some good. But obviously, that's a very sticky ethical question over which, you know, people in our pluralist democracy, right, are deeply divided. Okay. So this raises the very difficult question about who should decide, who should make decisions about what kind of research gets done, about whether or not wide-scale use of these technologies is implemented. Just to kind of let you know a little bit about some of the mechanisms that are currently in place, and these will be very familiar to you, but we have the U.S. coordinated framework in our country for the regulation of biotechnology, which pretty much includes the USDA, the FDA, and the EPA. And within the USDA, we also have the Animal Plant Health Safety Inspection group. They look at how to regulate some of these issues. But for example, I know that both the USDA and the FDA have had struggles with the case like the hornless cattle, right? Does that count as a genetically modified organism? Technically, they're using cattle DNA. They're not mixing cattle DNA with the DNA of something else, but they're editing. It's an edit. It's a cut, right? So that they don't grow horns. And the concern is, you know, under current regulations, it looks like that's permissible and doesn't require any regulation at all or testing. It's different than some of the other products. So there's a concern about, you know, how do we, you know, is that a meaningful distinction between editing, you know, deleting versus inserting DNA? It's not totally clear, right? So also, in addition to the regulatory agencies that we have, of course, we have in the past had the Presidential Commission for the Study of Bioethical Issues. And indeed, I believe they issued a report, I want to say it was just in 2015, maybe, on some of these biotechnologies and trying to give certain kinds of guidance under the Obama administration. Does anybody know what the status of this commission is today? The president's commission is? So, I mean, every president has the purview, right, to decide what commissions to have and what ones not. But the Presidential Commission for Bioethics has been disbanded. It was disbanded on January 17th, I think, so 3 days right before Trump took office. You can still access their website. It's actually been archived at the University of Georgetown, and they have an archive of all the reports that they filed over a fairly long period of time. But it is currently defunct. We don't have one, right? Which, you know, in my humble opinion, is unfortunate, right? Because typically in the past, the President's Commission for Bioethics has been a group of fairly diverse thinkers, people from, you know, the whole political spectrum, you know, people from both political parties, people who are very conservative, people who are very liberal. And they, you know, issue these reports by having kind of a very rigorous debate of the ethical issues involved. So in the past, it hasn't been, you know, so political. But, you know, at this point, it's not viewed as a priority. We do still have the Science Advisory Board, which basically is a group of mostly scientists who are appointed through to help be advisors to the EPA, the USDA, and FDA, USDA, and the EPA, those three. And they also are facilitators in a way, because not only do they advise about the science at stake and some of this, but they hold public forums and get public feedback. So participating in a science advisory board is another way where members of the public can kind of make their voice heard on some of these issues and, say something about how it is. It is very tricky because, for better or worse, some of the people who make up the regulatory agencies, I mean, they're politically appointed and they're often experts in the field. Who are the experts in the field? Often the same people who are the CEOs or stockholders of some of the companies that tend to benefit from these technologies. So there's a lot of conflicts of interest potentially at stake here. So it can be very tricky. Just because there's conflict of interest doesn't mean they're doing bad things, right? But it just means that we have to be kind of wary about that and ensure that, you know, voices are really being heard and that a diversity of views is really getting through, because it's not clear that's always a stake. And, you know, financial interests certainly can bias certain decisions. Just to let you know also, the Science Advisory Board recently did a poll of, they did a survey of scientists that were members of scientific, professional organizations, right? Like the AAAS, and in particular ones that were related to, bioengineering. And 70% of those scientists that were interviewed thought that we should have a moratorium on human germline genome editing, at least until we know more, until the risks are clear, until we, you know, have a better sense of, for example, what the probability of our off-target effects are, that this should not be allowed. One challenge of this is, again, we're one country in a big world. And there are countries like China who are charging ahead at full steam, right? China, I have no doubt, will be the first to do lots of experiments in humans with CRISPR technologies. And they've started. And they're starting to publish some of those results publicly as well. So, this is a very difficult thing. But I guess the question I'd like to raise, you know, for further discussion here today is, you know, whose values do we prioritize here? What risks are acceptable? And how do we make those decisions when these things are going to impact us so tremendously? So thank you. And I'm hoping to open it up for questions and discussion. So the question was, I've heard several people make this question. What's the problem with GMOs? Why do people get so freaked out about GMOs? Because really, selective breeding is something that's been done for thousands of years. I said hundreds, but really, you're right. It's been thousands of years. No one ever thought that was strange or had a problem with it. These technologies just allow us to do that much, much faster, right? It's much more efficient. I do think that some people make the distinction between, genetic modifications that introduce genetic material from a different organism, and those that don't. But indeed, the argument that many people make is we should not have a problem with GMO foods, because really it's something that, it's nothing new. It's, what's new is just that it's faster. So, it's very interesting, because in my own research, I study a lot of cases where there's kind of like a disconnect between, you know, science, scientific experts and sort of us, me, the layperson public, right? Mm-hmm. Issues about climate change. But GMOs is another one that's quite interesting. Because I think it's like 88% of AAAS scientists think that genetically modified foods are completely safe for human consumption and for the environment. It's like 37% of the public that believes that. And about 94% of the public, advocates for GMO labeling, right? So when we have those labels on our bread or on whatever that say GMO free or contains GMOs. And it's interesting, about why that is the case. But critics of GMOs will make the claim too that even the tests we use for things like safety, are contestable in the sense that, I mean, testing for safety is always hard because how long do you test? When can you say, okay, something's safe? No long-term side effects, right? And with drugs, this is a problem too. We could keep testing and keep testing and keep getting more evidence, but then that denies people access to those drugs. But the shorter time we test, the less we know about potential consequences. So it's it ends up again coming to this kind of value question about, well, what sorts of risks are acceptable given the benefits that might be yielded? I think there's two concerns that people have. I think you're raising two concerns there. One is, I mean, in general, with a lot of these kind of technologies, one of the kind of concerns that people have is, I think it gets articulated often as, you know, we're kind of like playing God here. You know, we're messing with the natural order of things. And there's something that's troubling about that, you know, about taking away what fish naturally do. But it is very tricky because, of course, we mess with the natural order of things all the time, right? You know, and I mean, you know, fighting cancer is one of them, right? Trying to prevent birth defects, right? So, you know, in the end, I think it comes down to a question of, well, you know, what is the benefit that's gained? Is it really worth the potential cost? And the other thing that's hard is, and this is the second concern that I think you are raising, when we mess with something like that, we're not always aware of what the implications are going to be, right? Salmon don't live by themselves in a bubble, right? They're a part of ecosystems. You know, I think we all know from what we've seen happen with the wolves going extinct in Yellowstone and the reintroduction of the wolves, that there were a lot of unexpected consequences that happened as a result of the ways in which the ecosystem changed. You know, for example, with the elk population and with certain kind of vegetation, that one thing can affect another. And so there's some concerns that when we do mess with some of these things, we're not totally sure what the consequences will be. And even though we often have a lot of optimism about the promises of technology, every technology that we've ever introduced has had unexpected consequences, right? Even the internet, right? I mean, I don't, you know, when I was a kid, I don't think there were worries about identity theft or, you know, those kind of things. Cyberbullying, it's a new world. There were two questions. One was, would it be possible to use genetic material from something, say something that's gone extinct, and then, you know, basically recreate animals with that sort of DNA? And again, I'm not an expert on some of the work that's been done on that, but I do know that there has been some work with the Chickasaw and the woolly mammoth and those kind of things to try to introduce some of that genetic material into current species, for example. The other question that you raised was about the first one that you raised.
Longevity,
yes. So the question was, these sorts of technologies, is there a concern that, you know, we're going to be, you know, sort of curing lots of diseases that determine kind of the lifespan of humans in a way that's going to increase human longevity to like 130 years old. And indeed, you know, I think that's a risk, right? I mean, whether or not you think that's a good thing or a bad thing, I guess is an open question. But I know even in my own classes, my students think that's a bad thing. they're young, so maybe they don't know. But one of the concerns that I hear people raise quite a bit is that is also related to population issues, right? Overpopulation. And you know, in many ways, we often do secure prolonging life, but sometimes that comes with the sacrifice of quality of life also. So these are hard issues. I can give you a couple of examples of mechanisms that are in place that many scientists are doing that are good. So, for example, we're now seeing an increase in what gets called community-based participatory research, right? Where researchers work with communities, where community members get to help define health issues that they want to see addressed. They get to help direct where the research questions go. You know, during the 1980s and 90s, during the HIV/AIDS crisis in the U.S., there were actually lots of AIDS patients and activists that became very active in trying to change the way clinical trials were being done, for example. There was that recent movie with Matthew McConaughey, Texas Dallas Buyers Club, that really talks about the, you know, how they didn't like the idea of doing these, you know, double-blind clinical trials because it meant some people weren't being treated, right? And people were dying, and people would share their medication with their loved ones so that maybe they'd at least also have a chance, you know? Though there are lots of important historical examples where ordinary citizens, right, advocated for themselves in ways that brought about change to the kind of science that was being done, the kinds of questions that were being asked, and the kind of methodologies being used. And it seems like those kind of mechanisms are important. We're also seeing a lot more efforts for scientists to engage in citizen science, right? And engaging people to participate in some of this as a way of increasing our understanding of the science and also potentially of some of the uncertainties of the science as well. Another mechanism that some places have tried are these kind of science juries, right? Where you put together something that is almost analogous to like a trial, where that's comprised of a jury of peers, right? Where issues will be presented and members of the community can decide whether or not, you know, a certain policy is allowed or a certain experiment's done. A lot of scientists don't like some of these ideas, right? In part because it does, you know, democracy, number one, democracy sometimes has bad results. Number two, democracy takes time. I mean, you know, this is the thing. And these are hard issues. Where people really do, reasonable people disagree about what sorts of risks are worth taking and which aren't, right? So, you know, scientists are like, look, we're moving at a pace where, and we're competing with scientists in other countries, and we can't just hold up everything to like have, you know, all these public meetings about it, and, you know, where people who may not fully understand the science get to decide some of this stuff. You know, I think more research, and here's a role that I think philosophers and sociologists of science and historians of science can play, is in really helping to collaborate with scientists to help them think through how can we get more public input on some of these issues, because it's important. So the question was, you know, given that genetic mutations also happen naturally, right? How do we know what mutations might come about as a result of changes we make? We don't, right, is the easy answer. I mean, it's very interesting because many of the different sciences that are in the business of studying life, we can easily start to think that we can control all these variables and understand all the mechanisms at place, and that is unlikely to be the case. One of the reasons why there is a disconnect sometimes between scientists and the public is in fact because there's a failure to facilitate trust, right, between the scientific community and the public. And in many ways, that's not the fault. You know, there are many things about that are not the fault of scientists. They sometimes are the fault of the media. They're sometimes the fault of politicians. They're sometimes the fault of many things. However, in science, we're also seeing an amazing increase in private funding of research. We have an atmosphere where all these things are being patented and where millions and millions and probably billions of dollars are at stake, where there's rampant conflicts of interest, as we were talking about earlier, where there are some cases, unfortunately, of scientific misconduct that get actually a lot of attention in the media, and then people are wary. There are concerns that scientists have, in some cases, political agendas, right? So one, you know, what I would advocate doing in some cases is trying to think about what we can do to kind of facilitate greater trust, and clearly transparency is going to be a big part of that. Some of the reason why transparency doesn't happen, though, is precisely because there are these commercial interests at stake and there's proprietary things, and so that also makes it challenging. But it also means that things like the National Science Foundation, the National Institutes of Health are really important organizations that we need to fund, and that public research on these topics is really crucial.